This is going out to the whole wide west side. Know what I'm saying? Yeah. Break it down for me. Steady mobbing, rock, rock on. I was just a young boy living in the hub city. Eastside Compton. Back in the days when Ice Cube and Easy had every talking about boy you can't.
This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 on the west side at UBC.
Too short, bumped in every super's boat and told us all how to ride for the west coast. My people singing, let me where you at, throw your gloves in the air and wave them like you just don't care. From LA to the bay, what you say? All day, every day, any damn day. Take a look around, we got the whole world locked down. Don't stop, we won't stop.
Hello, this is Marco. Welcome to Astro Talk, and it's going to be a new month soon, and I did a lot of new songs, a lot of new intros, and they're not appearing on my Astro Talk thing, so I'm sorry about that. Had to play TQ again, so did a lot of them and can't find them now, but anyway, welcome. There's lots always on Mars. NASA seems to love Mars. I think there's 7 spacecraft there. There's InSights going there. In 2020, is there going to be another one going there? So NASA seems to love Mars. They're searching for life on Mars, and it never stops. So there is an article on, where is it? I can't find it. I had it open. InSight. So the InSight mission steers towards Mars. So it says, dated May 23, 2018, says InSight steers towards Mars. It has a nice picture of the spacecraft, and it says NASA's InSight spacecraft is currently cruising to Mars. Yesterday, it performed its first course correction, guiding it to the red planet. I wonder how long it's going to take to get there. So here's the article. NASA's InSight lander has made its first course correction towards Mars. InSight, short for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy, and Heat Transport, is the first mission dedicated to exploring the deep interior of Mars. So the other missions, what happens is, I believe, like, for example, Opportunity Rover, they can go a couple centimeters down and dig. And what happens is, if there's presence of life on Mars, the ice has evaporated from the surface. So you got to dig down deep. So that's what InSight's going to do. It's going to dig deeper. And I believe Opportunity Rover, what happened, its drill bit stopped functioning more than about a year and a half ago, and they kind of fixed it, but they had to, I don't know if it's working how they want it to work, but anyway, InSight is going to dig deeper. So here's the article again. The lander is currently encapsulated in a protective aeroshell, which launched on top of an Atlas IV 401 rocket on May 5th from Vandenberg Air Force Base in Central California. I think it's the first mission that launched from the West Coast that had a spacecraft. Yesterday, the spacecraft fired its thrusters for the first time to change its flight path. The activity, called a trajectory correction maneuver, will happen a maximum of 6 times to guide the lander to Mars. So what I want to look for, I'm looking for a number here. I hope it will tell us how long it will take to get to Mars, because if humans eventually go to Mars, when NASA finally gets it going, because a lot of their projects, for example, the James Webb Telescope, was delayed again. I believe from the original plan, it was already supposed to be in space, so it's been delayed again, and who knows when it's going to be up. So who knows when people will go to Mars. So here goes. The article again. Every launch starts with a rocket. That's necessary to get the spacecraft out past Earth's gravity. But rockets don't complete the journey to other planets. Before launch, every piece of hardware headed to Mars is cleaned, limiting the number of Earth microbes that might travel on the spacecraft. However, the rocket in its upper stage, called a Centaur, don't get the same special treatment. As a result, Mars launches As a result, Mars launches involve aiming the rocket just off target so that it flies off into space. Separately, the spacecraft performs a series of trajectory correction maneuvers guiding it to the red planet. This makes sure that only the clean spacecraft lands on the planet while the upper stage does not come close. Oh, so they don't launch it directly at Mars because they want the rockets to get lost, get out of here, fly into space or land on Earth again, so they don't pollute the rocket. That's kind of interesting. So they have all these trajectory corrections. Precise calculations are required for InSight to arrive at exactly the right spot in Mars's atmosphere at exactly the right time, resulting in a landing on November 26th. So let's see, November 26th, May, June, July, August, September, October. When did that say? November. So about 6 months to get to Mars. Every step of the way, a team of navigators estimates the position and velocity of the spacecraft. Then they design maneuvers to deliver it to an entry point at Mars. That navigation team is based at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, my favorite place in the world, in Pasadena, California, which leads the InSight mission. So I believe what I've read is, who knows what's going to happen, but I believe the first time human goes to Mars, it'll take about 6 months to get there. And on this first time, just like what happened at the moon, they will circle Mars, but they won't land. I think that's what's going to happen. So human eyes and human hands and human brains can do a lot of science from up there when they're orbiting Mars. So that'll be pretty cool. But it might be a bit of a disappointment. Imagine heading there for 6 months, taking 6 months to get back, and then spending a month or two up there. So you're over a year in space and you don't land on Mars. So anyway, Fernando Abelaria of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, InSight's Deputy Mission Design and Navigation Manager, end quote, this first maneuver is the largest we'll conduct. The thrusters will fire for about 40 seconds to impart a velocity change of 3.8 meters per second or 8.5 miles per hour to the spacecraft. That will put us in the right ballpark as we aim for Mars, end quote. Especially at the beginning of that cruise, navigators rely on NASA's Deep Space Network, DSN, to track the spacecraft. The DSN is a system of antennas located at three sites around the Earth. As the planet rotates, each of these sites comes into range of NASA spacecraft, pinging them with radio signals to track the position. The antennas also send and receive data this way. Because the Earth rotates, there's going to be some times where if there was one deep space network tracking station, it would be able to receive signals from the spacecraft only a part of the day, because the other part, when it goes into nighttime, it will, or either daytime or nighttime, I'm not sure which one it is, but it will be on the other side of the planet, and it will not be able to receive the signals. So there's three. I think there's one in California, one in Australia or New Zealand, and one somewhere in Europe. So there's three of them located around the globe. So this ensures that when NASA is communicating with any spacecraft that is out in the solar system, it will receive the signal and it won't be blocked because the Deep Space Network station that would be in the other side of the Earth is not the only one out there. There's three of them, so they got it covered. So as the Earth rotates, the three Deep Space Network stations take turns receiving and sending signals to these spacecraft. Okay, so the Deep Space Network can give very accurate measurements about spacecraft position and velocity, but predicting where InSight will be after it fires its thrusters requires lots of modeling, Alberia said. As the cruise to Mars progresses, navigators have more information about the forces acting on a spacecraft. That lets them further refine their models. Combined with the Deep Space Network tracking measurements, these models allowed them to precisely drive the spacecraft to the desired entry point. So imagine all the millions and millions of things that they have to account for on any space mission. It's incredible. So this is another one. They want to make sure that the spacecraft arrives at Mars nice and clean. So the spacecraft itself is scrubbed, so no Earth microbes are there, because imagine if a spacecraft were sent to Mars with Earth microbes on it, and then they landed on the red planet, and then later one of the probes would discover something, and they'd say, oh, look, that's life. And it might just be a contamination from Earth. It might have a microbe from Earth, and it could be mistaken as a Mars microbe. So that's another thing that I have learned today, that they scrub these spacecrafts before the launch, and the rockets are sent on another trajectory, and this means they have to have course corrections throughout the flight to Mars, which is very interesting. So there's lots going on. I thought it was pretty straightforward, but it seems like there's lots of modeling, a lot of communication with the spacecraft, and then a lot of real-time adjustments. Kind of interesting. So says Albilaria again, and quote, navigation is all about statistics, probability, and uncertainty. As we gather more information on the forces acting on the spacecraft, we can better predict how it is moving and how future maneuvers will affect its path. Yesterday's 42nd burn, so this article was on May 23. What do you know? It is yesterday's. Yesterday's 42nd burn relies on 4 of 8 thrusters on the spacecraft. A separate group of 4 is autonomously fired on a daily basis to keep the spacecraft's solar panels trained on the sun and its antennas pointed at Earth. While necessary to maintain orientation, these small daily firings also introduce errors that navigators have to account for and counterbalance. So so says Alan Hazel of JPL, an InSight navigation team chief, and quote, everyone has been working hard since launch to assess what these small forces have done to the trajectory. People have worked lots of hours to look at that. For engineers, it's a very interesting problem and fun to try to figure out, end quote. When the spacecraft is just a few hours from Mars, the planet's gravitational pull or gravity well will begin to reel the spacecraft in. At that point, InSight's team will prepare for the next milestone after cruise, entering Mars's atmosphere, descending to the surface, and sticking in InSight's landing. So that's the end of the article. It just tells a bit about JPL. So this reminded me about when I was talking to Trina Ray, and I'll talk about the Trina Ray interview I did, another one, a couple of weeks ago, when the Cassini spacecraft was making its final dive in between Saturn's rings and the planet of Saturn. They first did not know if it would be a benign place, if there would be contamination, ions, rocks, little pebbles. They didn't know if the spacecraft would survive. So after the first dive between the rings, it did survive. So what happens is, as it's going in its final dive, when it went into Saturn's atmosphere, broke apart, and then burned up, it had little thrusters. And it always has little thrusters because its antenna has to point towards Earth. If it's a little bit off, maybe we won't receive the signal. So I didn't realize how much work is involved in this. It seems that maybe they have to have someone always making sure that the spacecraft navigation is right on, is bang on, its antennas are pointing towards Earth. So you can imagine the Voyager, I believe it's the Voyager 2 spacecraft. Trina Ray said Voyager 1, but I thought Voyager 2 left the solar system first. So it is so far out. It is way out there. It is past the sun's atmosphere, and the sun's atmosphere is the limit of the solar system. So it is an interstellar space. It's sending a signal that has the power of a refrigerator 20-watt light bulb, and it has to be pointed towards Earth. Imagine if it lost its navigation and pointed out towards another star, then they couldn't receive the signal. So what happens then is these are, it seems, not such a straightforward thing. It seems that there's a lot of effort involved in it, a lot of planning, and then when they're doing it, it's a real-time thing. There's lots of calculations. There's a lot of feedback, and they have to keep the antenna pointed towards Earth. Kind of interesting. So this was a pretty good article. I think it was a nice article. Insight steers towards Mars. So it's got a nice little picture of the inside capsule, and it's on www.nasa.gov, dated May 23, 2018. So I'm getting a ad pretty soon, and Dora is going to help me with it. Thank you, Dora. And she's going to make it nice and cute and professional, something I can't do. So what I'm going to do is, when I come back, I'm going to talk more about the Trina Wright interview. So I interviewed on May 1st, and it's all done. It's on my website, www.marcosastrotalk.com. That's Marcos, M-A-R-C-O-S, Astro, A-S-T-R-O, talk.com. It was about a 55-minute interview, and I had a great time, because whenever you learn about astronomy, it's fun, and at least for me it is. And Trina Ray is probably one of the best people in this universe to learn, because she is so well-spoken. She is incredibly knowledgeable. And when she explains things, I just go, wow, it's really cool what she does. So when we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy, and I'll tell you about the Trina Ray interview. But now I'm going to go for a break. So thank you for listening. This is Marco on Marco's Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I
breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds lift, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're...
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
A well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
This is going out to the whole wide west side. Know what I'm saying? Yeah. Break it down for me. Steady mob, rock on.
just a young boy living in the hub city.
Eastside Compton.
Back in the days when Ice Cube and Easy had everything. Talking about boy, you can't.
This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 on the west side at UBC.
Too short, bumped in every super's boat and told us all how to ride for the west coast.
My people, you hear me where you at? Throw your gloves in the air and wave them like you just don't care. From LA to the Bay, what you say? All day, every day, any damn day. Take a look around. We got the whole world locked down.
We know, don't stop.
We won't stop.
That's why I put it down for the west side.
Long ago,
oh no.
We were still in 40s out the liquor store.
Oh no.
Mama started tripping, so it's time to go.
Out to the park with the locusts.
Everybody broke, smoking roaches.
DJ Quick was the had every claiming he was from the CPT.
Y'all remember?
One time tried to clown. We had to burn this bitch on down.
Welcome back. This is Marco with TQ. And as I said, there was some reason that I did some more promos, some intros with different music, and they don't appear on my thing. So they don't appear on my file. And what happened is first you have to save it as a project and then you save it as a podcast. And that's what I had a problem with Trina Ray's interview as well. I saved it as a project and then saved it as a podcast and it just wouldn't save. So I had to save it to the desktop, and then it worked. So right now, I'm having problems. I'll check that out after my show. I'll ask some of the knowledgeable people here. For some reason, my podcasts are not saved into my AstroTalk folder. So as I said, I had about 7 or 8 brand new musical tunes to bring to you guys, and I can't find them. So maybe I'll solve this after. So, welcome back. And as I said, I have an interview with Trina Ray. So, it was kind of interesting because Trina Ray, she's a mission scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. So, I believe she told me she had dedicated 21 years of the past, of her life, of her past 21 years, to this Cassini mission. So, she's been working on it for a long time. And when these scientists work on it, it means work. And like they do a lot of hours and they love it. And you know what? They're lucky because they're doing something they love and it's really interesting. Imagine you got a spacecraft out in Saturn and you're controlling it and you're doing all this cool science and you're making all these discoveries. So I think Trina Ray said there's going to be 4,000 write-ups or journal write-ups. There could be more and there's lots coming. And then she'll head off to another project soon where they're launching to Europa. They're going to study the moon of Jupiter, and it has a subsurface ocean. And I asked Trina about that. One of the things they can test, one of the tests they do to see if a moon has a subsurface ocean, it can rock a certain way because of its orbit and the gravitational pull, I guess, from the planet. But if it's got water below its surface, it will rock kind of differently. It will be a different kind of rocking, and they can measure that. And from that rocking itself, they can tell if there's a subsurface ocean or how much water is underneath. So when you have, like in the Jupiter system, you have Europa. I believe it's the biggest moon in the solar system, and it's got a subsurface ocean, or so NASA tells us. Then, you know, you have to do a test to see if this underground ocean exists. Whereas in the Saturn system, you have the moon Enceladus. It's kind of cool. It's got an icy surface, and it spouts geysers, so they can see the water coming out. And I guess, you know, when you're in Saturn's vicinity, it's kind of cold, isn't it? Maybe minus 200 degrees. And I believe as soon as the geysers shoot out the water from, I believe, the south pole of Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, then it's going to freeze. It's going to be like not droplets of water, droplets of ice everywhere. So they can see that. But in Europa, they have to do a lot of different tests. So that's kind of interesting. So how did I get off? Oh, yeah, I was talking about Trina Ray. So we had the interview and stubborn me. She's the specialist. She's the expert. She knows so much. She's got postgraduate degrees. She's a genius. And she says, let's talk about the dive between Saturn and its rings. And I kept going back in the interview to Titan. Because I'm really interested in Titan. It's got this thick atmosphere, and it's got methane and, I believe, ethane lakes on its surface and rivers and mountains and everything. And I kept going back to Titan. I guess Trina might have noticed that, and she's such a nice person. She didn't say, Margo, stay on the topic, which was the diving between the rings. But I kept going back to Titan because I'm really interested. And one day I hope to get somebody from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to talk specifically about Titan. So I think Titan is the second largest moon in the solar system. It is Saturn's largest moon, and it is a big moon, and it's got a big, I think it's got the thickest atmosphere in the solar system, and you can't see through that atmosphere. So there's a Huygens probe, that's H-U-Y-G-E-N-S, the Huygens probe that was part of the Cassini spacecraft. They send it down to the floor of Titan. So they were on the surface of Titan, and they saw all these methane lakes and rivers and everything, and it was pretty cool. So I kept going back to Titan, where Trina Ray wanted to talk about the dives. But she was very nice. She's such a nice person, and she went with it. And we did talk so much about the dive between the rings, and she brought up a lot of knowledge about that. And it was so interesting because I didn't know, for example, they didn't know much. They didn't know all they wanted to know about Jupiter's atmosphere and its magnetic field. So she says, as the planet and the rings, and so there's the planet, there's the rings, and the spacecraft dives in between the planet and the rings. So it's got all this kind of gravity and all these tests they're doing. And she said there's large masses of Saturn, that were tugging on the spacecraft that did this. And it was tugged on by the rings. And it was really interesting to listen to her. And I can imagine those write-ups. Hopefully I can get some of those on, or I can tell you about them. But I did have the interview with Trina Ray. And as I said, it's on www.marcosastrotalk.com. It is on the section that is about what's it called again? I have to open my website, but anyway, it's on space missions and stuff like that. So let me sorry about this. Marcosastrotalk.com. There we go. Okay, so there's my website, and it's on telescopes and space missions. So this interview, it's really, to me, it was like, I'm so impressed with these scientists. And not just that, I mean, it's not always easy for somebody like me to get a noted scientist on here, especially from NASA, and she consented. So it's on www.nasa.gov in the page telescopes and space missions. So listen to that. It's about almost an hour, and it is so cool because she knows her onions. There's an idiom for you. Okay, so now I'm going to go to another topic. I talked about the InSight lander because it's an important one, because I wanted to talk about astrophysics today mostly, but this is going to be interesting because InSight's going to dig deeper into the surface of Mars than any other spacecraft has done before, or any other rover. And it's going to, I guess, hopefully, I believe that's what NASA is looking for. They're looking for this underground water because the hydrogen on the surface evaporated because Mars's atmosphere was lost. So scientists do believe that Mars had an atmosphere before, and it floated away. So there's a very thin, whimsy atmosphere, I believe, there. But there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in its ionosphere. A lot of ions floating around. A lot of cool science to be learned about what's happening in the atmosphere of Mars. Just like in our planet, it's so cool to read up on the ionosphere and what the physics of these atmosphere and what's happening, and it is so interesting. So the InSight rover will because the surface water and surface ice, and scientists do believe there was surface water and surface ice in abundance, there could have been life. So, and they've caught signs of hydrogen, which is an indicator of life, and all this other stuff. There's lots of signs. I shouldn't open my mouth and say what they caught because I don't have it right in front of me and I'm not an expert. But they are looking with the insight. They are looking to dig deeper into Mars. And when they dig deeper into Mars, maybe they'll find what they're looking for. So, as I said, I wanted to do astrophysics. So let's do some astrophysics. Let's talk about our good little friends. They're little, but they're big. That's weird, isn't it? They're little, but they're heavy. They're black holes. So, May 9th, 2018, there's a article, Black Hole Bounty Captured in the Milky Way Center. So it shows a picture here. It's dated May 9. It's on www.nasa.gov. So again, the title is Black Hole Bounty Captured in the Milky Way Center. So I believe when I was reading about this a few weeks ago or last month, scientists believe there could be up to 20,000 invisible, now they're invisible, black holes rotating around our central black hole, which is called Sagittarius A star. So you have to forgive me. Sometimes I've listened to my podcast and I say Sagittarius A, but it's called Sagittarius A star. Star is an asterisk. So it's big SGR, big A, and asterisk. So that is the name of our black hole. It's about 4.6 million solar masses. So it's a big one. It is a supermassive black hole. And what they're talking about, I believe, is there's solar mass black holes, which are the size of 4, 5, 10, 20 suns, that are rotating around this. And they can't find them now, evidence, but they do believe. They're looking for X-ray signals. And so let's read the article. It's called, again, Black Hole Bounty Captured in the Milky Way Center, May 9th, 2018, on www.nasa.gov. Astronomers, oh, let me stop this for a second. I was going to mention, after Trina Ray, I've been accepted into a few NASA programs. I'll tell you about that after I finish this article. How about that? Okay. So, astronomers have discovered evidence for thousands of black holes located near the center of our Milky Way galaxy using data from NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. This black hole bounty consists of stellar mass black holes, which typically weigh between 5 to 20 times the mass of the Sun. So this is a stellar mass black hole. And again, just to repeat, Sagittarius A star is at the center of our galaxy. It powers the galaxy, and they believe every galaxy has a supermassive black hole, or nearly every galaxy has a supermassive black hole at its center. And there's an interesting dynamic that goes on between how the black hole it sits there and how it controls our galaxy. So it's necessary. It's the heart of our galaxy, the Milky Way. So this is a supermassive black hole. They think there's about 20,000 solar mass black holes rotating around Sagittarius A star. So I'm going to go back to the article, and what I just said, they'll probably repeat. Okay, here we go. Theoretical studies of the dynamics of stars and galaxies have indicated that a large population of stellar mass black holes, as many as 20,000, could drift inward over the eons and collect around Sagittarius A star. This recent analysis using Chandra data is the first observational evidence for such a black hole bounty. A black hole by itself is invisible. However, a black hole or neutron star locked in close orbit with a star will pull gas from its companion. Astronomers call these systems X-ray binaries. This material falls onto a disk and heats up to millions of degrees and produces X-ray signals before disappearing into the black hole. Some of these X-ray binaries appear as point-like sources in the Chandra image. So, I'm not sure this is kind of interesting. So, as it says here, the material is pulled from another star by the black hole, and as it gathers and in orbit and goes around in a circle, and as it is falling into the black hole, it heats to millions of degrees. And when it heats to millions of degrees, it sends us an X-ray signal. So I thought the X-ray signal would have to point directly towards Earth, but maybe the X-ray signal goes off in every direction. So I'm not sure. I guess a gamma ray burst would be like a jet pointing out from the center on each opposite end. So maybe that gamma ray burst would have to be pointed directly towards Earth. But it seems here that maybe the signals given on off these X-ray signals can be thrown off in so many directions or in every direction, so they can be seen or felt or detected. That's a good word. A team of researchers led by Chuck Halley of Columbia University in New York used Chandra data to search for X-ray binaries containing black holes that are located near Sagittarius A star. They studied the X-ray spectra, that is the amount of X-ray seen at different energies of sources within about 12 light years of Sagittarius A star. So again, Sagittarius A star is our central black hole that powers our galaxy. And they've looked at a area that is about 12 light years around Sagittarius A star. I'm not sure if that's a radius or if that's a diameter. The team then selected sources with X-ray spectra similar to those of known X-ray binaries, which have relatively large amounts of low energy X-rays. Using this method, they detected 14 X-ray binaries within about 3 light years of Sagittarius A star. Two X-ray sources likely to contain neutron stars, based on the detection of characteristic outbursts in previous studies, were then eliminated from the analysis. So they found two sources that were, they thought, neutron stars. The dozen remaining X-ray binaries are identified in the labeled version of the image using red colored circles. Other sources with relatively large amounts of high energy X-rays are labeled in yellow. Where am I? I lost my space. And are mostly binaries containing white dwarf stars. Isn't that cool? There's white dwarf stars, neutron stars, black holes, all kinds of cool red giants, super giants, or whatever they're called, blue-white giants, all over the place. So cool to look for stars. Haley and his collaborators concluded that a majority of these dozen X-ray binaries are likely to contain black holes. The amount of variability they have shown over time scales of years is different from that expected for X-ray binaries containing neutron stars. Only the brightest X-ray binaries containing black holes are likely to be detectable at the distance of Sagittarius A star. Therefore, the detections in the study imply that a much larger population of fainter undetected X-ray binaries, at least 300 and up to 1,000 containing stellar mass black holes, should be present around Sagittarius A star. So remember, Sagittarius A star is 26,000 light years from us. So we're 26,000 light years from the center of our galaxy. So to see these things, I think Hubble has a certain limit where it can see. And it seems Chandra, if it were closer, it could see more, right? So it just makes sense. This population of black holes with companions near Sagittarius A star This population of black holes with companion stars near Sagittarius A star could provide insight into the formation of X-ray binaries from close encounters between stars and black holes. This discovery could also inform future gravitational wave research. Knowing the number of black holes in the center of a typical galaxy can help in better predicting how many gravitational wave events may be associated with them. An even larger population of stellar mass black holes without companion stars should be present near Sagittarius A star. So they're saying there should be a lot more black holes, stellar mass black holes around Sagittarius A star. As I said in the beginning, up to 20,000. According to theoretical follow-up work by Alexei Genarozov of Columbia and his colleagues, more than about 10,000 black holes and as many as 40,000 black holes should exist in the center of the galaxy, our Milky Way. While the authors strongly favor the black hole explanation, they cannot rule out the possibility that up to about a half of the deserved dozen sources are from a population of millisecond pulsars, very rapidly rotating neutron stars with strong magnetic fields. That's kind of interesting. So they think that some of these are pulsars. So what happens is when a star, a big star dies, it goes supernova. If it's big enough, it'll go black hole. If it's not big, quite big enough, it'll become a neutron star. And I think 7, 8, or 10% of neutron stars become pulsars with great big gravitational fields, very strong. I believe they're the most gravitationally strong things in our universe. But then all of a sudden there's a new contender that comes along and knocks them from their perch. So there's possible that these are the most magnetic things. So a pulsar is a millisecond pulsar, which means it would rotate about 1,000 times or 700, 800, 900 times a second. So in 1 second, it would spin 900 revolutions. Isn't that crazy? So it's very powerful. It sends a powerful pulse. So the authors are saying they cannot rule out that some, about half of the observed dozen sources are from millisecond pulsars, very rapidly rotating neutron stars with strong magnetic fields. So if a pulsar was strong enough or close enough to the Earth, a neutron star, it would strip our credit cards of all its data and probably far worse. It would, ionize the atoms in our body, so we'd be dead. So it would take electrons off our atoms and we die. So these things are not good. So they're at the center of our Milky Way, which is a good thing. So a paper describing these results appeared in the April 5 issue of the journal Nature. NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, manages the Chandra program for NASA's Science Mission Directorate in Washington. The Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, controls Chandra science and flight operations. And more can be read on www.nasa.gov/Chandra. So when I come back, I'm going to do another article, but also I'm going to talk a little bit about something cool that happened to me with NASA. And I'm looking for the angry listener. Where is, there he is. I got the angry listener. So when I come back, I'm going to talk more astronomy and what I'm going to do for NASA. And thank you for listening. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum! Take him in the teeth, Red Hurts!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate him, I hate
okay,
him!
Okay, well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only...
That's it. Pack it up.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9.
Welcome back. That was Moni Love and Sarah. Sarah used to work here. And one thing I got to say about Sarah, she's got one of the best radio voices I've ever heard. Isn't it nice? So that was Moni Love. I'm dubbing her in and out. So Moni Love used to sing with Queen Latifah. I loved Moni Love. She was pretty cool. She had a cool hat. So now we're going to get back to more astronomy and let me tell you what happened with NASA. Okay, so I applied for a few programs with NASA and I'm going to apply for more. So I want to look for exoplanets. I think that'll be fun. Imagine if I discover a planet, my life is made. It'll be so cool. So there's lots of citizen scientists, they're called, working for NASA because NASA can't possibly afford to hire millions and thousands of scientists. So what they do, they make a lot of their data and pictures available, and citizen scientists will process data and make pictures and do all kinds of cool stuff with NASA. So I applied for the it's called OSIRIS-REx, OSIRIS-REx, the OSIRIS-REx mission. So REx is big R, small e, big X. So RE stands for regolith, so that's the surface, that's the dirt that comes off the off the asteroid. And X is explorer, so I know what REx stands for, I don't know what OSIRIS, I can't remember it just offhand. So they are traveling to asteroid Bennu, and I believe on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2019, they will get there, and they will do tests of the asteroid Bennu, and then they will collect samples. And it's pretty cool. They go close to the asteroid, and then they blow, I think, hydrogen gas at it. And then the regolith that comes off, they collect it, and they will put it in the spacecraft. And when the spacecraft returns, NASA can examine that. So I applied to be a OSIRIS-REx ambassador, so I want to give speeches about it. I emailed them, and they said it takes a while before because there's a long lineup, and they got to process it. But I was accepted into searching for certain things with a telescope. So I have to get a nice telescope, take pictures. And I think what I wanted to do was search for brown dwarfs that are just outside of the solar system. And they're floating around out there. There's supposed to be a lot of brown dwarfs. But also I think they want me to search for planets with a telescope. And that'll be cool if I can do that, if I can borrow a telescope. And you can join, like, the Royal Astronomical Society, and then they can lend you telescopes. So I'll try to do that. So I was accepted into that. I would feel happy about that. That will be harder to do because you have to take your telescope out to a nice dark area and take pictures. So that'll be a hard thing. But I do want to be an OSIRIS-REx ambassador, and I'm going to apply for looking for exoplanet from NASA data. So what they do is, how they search for exoplanets, they take a light, what's it called? Just a graph. It's not coming to me now. But the light from the star, and if a planet goes in front of the star, it will dim that star's light coming to us by just the smallest fraction, just the smallest amount. So you look for little dips in the light intensity from, it's called a light curve, I think. I think it's called a light curve. So you look at light curves, and then you examine the light curves, and you try to look for dips. And as I'm going to tout her again, Michelle Kunimoto of UBC, she's a grad student. She, I believe, found four planets, because NASA, I guess it does, it looks for this data with computers and algorithms, and they don't search past a certain limit. And if you look at the data that they didn't look at, maybe you can find a planet. So I hope to maybe find a planet one day. So I want to join the exoplanet hunters thing. And I'll have to, I wrote it down somewhere. I'm going to apply to them, and hopefully I can start searching for planets. So that will be fun. Okay, so now let's look at magnetosphere. Is it magnetosphere or is it magnetosphere? Is it tomato or tomato? Well, depends on what you like. So here's, there's magnetosphere multiscale. It's on May 9th, 2018. It says NASA spacecraft discovers new magnetic process in turbulent space. For those close to home, the space immediately around Earth is full of hidden secrets and invisible processes. So again, space is not a, it's a very dynamic place. And when you say empty space, there's no such thing as empty space. Because I believe there's the fabric, there's the fabric of space-time, and then there's particles popping in and out of existence all over the place in space. There's magnetic fields. There's incredible amount of turbulent, violent physics going on in these places. So the space immediately around Earth is full of hidden secrets and invisible processes. In a new discovery reported in the journal Nature, scientists working with NASA's Magnetosphere Multiscale Spacecraft, MMS, have uncovered a new type of magnetic event in our near-Earth environment by using an innovative technique to squeeze extra information out of the data. Magnetic reconnection is one of the most important processes in space. filled with charged particles known as plasma. And this is the space around Earth. This fundamental process dissipates magnetic energy and propels charged particles, both of which contribute to a dynamic space weather system that scientists want to better understand and even someday predict, as we do terrestrial weather. So I remember I did an article before on this, Magnetic Recreation, where they studied the atmosphere of Earth, and magnetic reconnection goes on in that. So I don't remember the article, but it was pretty cool. It was about Earth's atmosphere and all the cool stuff that goes on in the atmosphere. So back to the article. This fundamental process dissipates magnetic energy and propels charged particles, both of which contribute to a dynamic space weather system that scientists want to better understand and even someday predict, as we do terrestrial weather. Reconnection occurs when cross-magnetic field lines snap, explosively flinging away nearby particles at high speeds. The newly discovered found reconnection, where it has never been seen before, in turbulent plasma. So it shows a nice couple of pictures here about plasma, and plasma physics can be very complicated. Fluid physics can be very complicated. So remember, when scientists talk about fluid, physicists, liquid and air is a fluid because they both flow. So when you're talking about not just fluid dynamics, you're talking about not just the fluid, you're talking about air flowing. So air is classified as fluid. Of course, solids do not flow. If you put a solid in a container, it will not take the shape of the container. It will just sit there and be stupid. But fluid, it's got layers, and the layers of water or whatever, or oil or methane, they flow around each other. And that's what happens with air too. It flows around. So air is considered a fluid by physicists. So the new discovery found reconnection where it has never been seen before in turbulent plasma. So says Tai Fan, a senior fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, and quote, in the plasma universe, there are two important phenomena, magnetic reconnection and turbulence. This discovery bridges these two processes. So again, turbulent flow, it's when you have not just fluid, you have air flowing around. It's very turbulent. The mathematics for it can be very complicated. It's not an easy thing to discern. So back to the article. Magnetic reconnection has been observed innumerable times in the magnetosphere, the magnetic environment around Earth, but usually under calm conditions. I'm sorry, I didn't say that again. I should have said that in the beginning. The magnetosphere is the magnetic environment around Earth. It is created because there are ions that circulate inside the Earth below the surface, and these ions, they're like electric current. So when electric current flows, it creates a magnetic field. So this creates a magnetic field around Earth, which protects us from space weather and all the dangerous stuff. Okay, back to the article. Where was I? Magnetic reconnection has been observed innumerable times in the magnetosphere, the magnetic environment around Earth, but usually under calm conditions. The new event occurred in a region called the magnetosheath, just outside the outer boundary of the magnetosphere, where the solar wind is extremely turbulent. Previously, scientists didn't know if reconnection even could occur there, as the plasma is highly chaotic in that region. MMS, the spacecraft, found that it does, but on scales much smaller than previous spacecraft could probe. So there's interesting physics going on in, even if you consider empty space, it's not empty. There's all kinds of particles popping in and out of existence. There's magnetic fields. There's all kinds of chaos going on in there. And MMS is probing this. And it shows a nice picture, and it's a video. In a turbulent magnetic environment, magnetic field lines become scrambled. Where am I? Sorry, I keep losing my place. What's wrong with me today? As the field lines cross, intense electric currents, shown here as bright regions, form and eventually trigger magnetic reconnection, indicated by a flash, which is an explosive event that releases magnetic energy accumulated in the current layers and ejects high-speed bidirectional jets of electrons. NASA's Magnetosphere Multiscale Mission, MMS, witnessed this process in action as it flew through the electron jets, the turbulent boundary just at the edge of Earth's magnetic environment. And, oh, so that's the picture. So when we talk about the magnetosphere, it looks like a teardrop. So towards the sun, it's round, and in the back, it kind of tapers off in a long, long line. It looks, so it makes the magnetosphere look like a teardrop. So there's different layers in the magnetosphere. There's the magnetosheath, there's this, there's that. There's maybe five different layers, maybe more, maybe less. I'm not sure. I don't have the data right in front of me. But the magnetosphere is an interesting thing. It's where the auroras occur. And it protects us from solar wind and all the particles that could kill us from space. So MMS uses four identical spacecraft flying in a pyramid formation to study magnetic reconnection around Earth in three dimensions. Because the spacecraft fly incredibly close together at an average separation of just 4.5 miles, they hold the record for closest separation of any multi-spacecraft formation. They are able to observe phenomena no one has seen before. Furthermore, MMS's instruments are designed to capture data at speeds 100 times faster than previous missions. So imagine if 400 or 500 years ago, or 200 years ago, or 100 years ago, if scientists had all this high-tech stuff, could they have made the same discoveries? Wow. And imagine what's going to happen as the spacecraft dig deeper, and as technology gets better, and if our knowledge increases, man, our knowledge is just exponentially going up. So even though the instruments aboard MMS are incredibly fast, they are still too slow to capture turbulent reconnection in action, which requires observing narrow layers of fast-moving particles hurled by the recoiling field lines. So if I remember in a physics lesson I did, if you have a tube, let's say you have a tube and water is flowing through the tube. So these layers, friction, they flow against each other. So they rub against each other, but they still flow past each other. So let's see, what did I say that? Even though the instruments are incredibly fast, they're still too slow to capture the turbulent reconnection in action, which requires observing narrow layers of fast-moving particles hurled by the recoiling field lines. So these magnetic lines that are breaking hurl layers of fast-moving particles out. So there are layers. They're like a fluid, even though maybe they're not a fluid. Maybe they're a gas. Maybe they're in the gas form or the vapor form, but they're still considered a fluid. So as the particles are being sent out, they're being measured, but the camera is still too slow to capture the turbulent reconnection in action compared to standard reconnection, in which broad jets of ion streams out from the site of reconnection. Turbulent reconnection ejects narrow jets of electrons only a couple miles wide. Wow, narrow, and it's only a couple miles wide. So imagine this, broad jets of ion streams. Wow. So these are, I bet, in the gas stage, but they're still considered a fluid because, as I said, a fluid is, for physicists, a fluid can be a gas or a liquid because they both flow. So when a scientist or an engineer, or when they're learning about it, when they have a spacecraft, a spacecraft could do it, but let's say an airplane. So an airplane takes off, and what they study is the wind that flies past the wings, and that gives the aircraft its lift. So it's like a fluid. So even though it's air, it's a fluid. So let's listen to somebody called Jonathan Eastwood, a lecturer at Imperial College London and a co-author of the paper. And quote, "The smoking gun evidence is to measure oppositely directed electron jets at the same time, and the four MMS spacecraft were lucky to corner the reconnection site and detect both jets." And quote, "Crucially, MMS scientists were able to leverage the design of one instrument, the fast plasma investigation, to create a technique to interpolate the data, essentially allowing them to read between the lines and gather extra data points in order to resolve the jets." So says Amy Rager, a graduate student at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And quote, and just wait, and she's the scientist who developed the technique. Wow. end quote. The key event of the paper happens in only 45 milliseconds. This would be one data point with the basic data. But instead, we can get 67 data points in that region with this method, allowing us to understand what is happening, end quote. So it's a complicated stuff and complicated theories, and they make their models, and then they tell us this is what happened. With the new method, the MMS scientists are hopeful they can comb back through existing data sets to find more of these events and potentially others unexpected discoveries as well. Magnetic reconnection occurs throughout the universe so that we can learn about it around our planet, where it's easier for Earthlings to examine it, so we can apply that information to other processes farther away. The finding of reconnection and turbulence has implications, for example, for studies on the sun. It may help scientists understand the role magnetic reconnection plays in heating the inexplicably hot solar corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, and accelerating the supersonic solar wind. NASA's upcoming Park Solar Probe mission launches directly to the sun in the summer of 2018 to investigate exactly those questions, and that research is all the better armed the more we understand about magnetic reconnection at home. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You were listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.